conditioning, through which various forms of persuasion are used to stimulate certain types of behaviors while suppressing others. In anticipation of future gamification techniques as means of behavioral modification, the subcommittee report also noted with apprehension more benign approaches that relied on positive reinforcement, from Gold Star incentives to elaborate reward systems, in order to restructure personality through artificially applied techniques. The generalized obsession with controlling violence had also produced methods of behavior prediction that raise profound questions with respect to due process, privacy, and individual liberties. A psychologist writing in the American Psychological Association's journal Monitor in 1974 sounded the alert, warning colleagues who touted their ability to control behavior that they were now viewed with increasing suspicion, if not revulsion, and threatened with restriction. The social control of behavior control is underway. The subcommittee's work had enduring consequences. Not only did prisoners and patients' rights groups gain momentum in their efforts to end the behavioral oppression suffered in public institutions, but psychologists also began to discuss the need to professionalize their discipline with clear ethical standards, accreditation procedures, training programs, and career ladders. The National Research Act, passed in 1974, stipulated the creation of institutional review boards and laid the foundation for the evolution and institutionalization of the Common Rule for the Ethical Treatment of Human Subjects, from which Facebook famously held itself exempt. That same year, Congress established the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research. When the commission published its findings 5 years later in the Belmont Report, it became the professional standard for imposing ethical guidelines on all federally funded research with human subjects in the U.S. The clamorous rights consciousness of the 1970s drove behavior modification from civilian life, or at least dimmed its star. A Federal Bureau of Prisons official recommended that program leaders avoid using the term behavioral modification, but to talk about positive reward and reinforcements for the type of behavior we are attempting to instill. Another said, "We're doing what we always did, but to call it behavior modification just makes things more difficult." Skinner's 1976 primer titled About Behaviorism, motivated by what he believed were public misconceptions stirred by the wave of harsh reaction to Beyond Freedom and Dignity, failed to capture much public attention. According to Skinner's biographer, the battle had climaxed. The public had made Beyond Freedom and Dignity a bestseller, but had just as surely rejected Skinner's argument that there were cultural matters more important than preserving and extending individual freedom. Most fascinating is that throughout these years of anxiety and debate, it was impossible to imagine the means of behavioral modification as anything other than owned and operated by the government, a privileged modality of state power. A 1966 Harvard Law Review article addressed issues of electronic tracking, surveillance, and behavioral control, reasoning that it would consider governmental attempts to change conduct, since these seem more likely than private attempts. The democratic impulse of U.S. society, repelled by the excesses of its intelligence agencies, their support of criminal activities undertaken by the Nixon administration, and the migration of behavior modification as a means of disciplinary control in state institutions, led to the rejection of behavioral modification as an extension of governmental power. Unknown to the senators, scholars, rights activists, legislators, and many other citizens who stood against the anti-democratic incursions of the behavioral engineering vision, these methods had not died. The project would resurface in a wholly unexpected incarnation as a creature of the market, its unprecedented digital capabilities, scale, and scope now flourishing under the flag of surveillance capitalism. During the same years that U.S. democratic forces combined to resist behavior modification as a form of state power, the energies of capitalist counterinsurgency were already at work within society. The corporation was to enjoy the rights of personhood, but be free of democratic obligations, legal constraints, moral calculations, and social considerations. Certainly, in the U.S. case, a weakened state in which elected officials depended upon corporate wealth in every election cycle has shown little appetite to contest behavior modification as a market project, let alone to stand for the moral imperatives of the autonomous individual. In its latest incarnation, behavioral modification comes to life as a global digital market architecture, unfettered by geography, independent of constitutional constraints, and formally indifferent to the risks it poses to freedom, dignity, or the sustenance of the liberal order that Irvin's subcommittee was determined to defend. This contrast is even more distressing in light of the fact that in the mid-20th century, the means of behavior modification were aimed at individuals and groups who were construed as them. Military enemies, prisoners, and other captives of walled disciplinary regimes. Today's means of behavioral modification are aimed unabashedly at us. Everyone is swept up in this new market dragnet, including the psychodramas of ordinary, unsuspecting 14-year-olds approaching the weekend with anxiety. Every avenue of connectivity serves to bolster private power's need to seize behavior for profit. Where is the hammer of democracy now, when the threat comes from your phone, your digital assistant, your Facebook login? Who will stand for freedom now, when Facebook threatens to retreat into the shadows if we dare to be the friction that disrupts economies of action that have been carefully, elaborately, and expensively constructed to exploit our natural empathy, elude our awareness, and circumvent our prospects for self-determination? If we fail to take notice now, how long before we are numb to this incursion and to all the incursions? How long until we notice nothing at all? How long before we forget who we were before they owned us, bent over the old texts of self-determination in the dim light, the shawl around our shoulders, magnifying glass in hand, as if deciphering ancient hieroglyphs? Throughout these chapters, we have returned to the essential questions that define the division of learning. Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? As to who knows, we have seen the titanic agglomerations of knowledge about our behavior in the shadow text, from vast patterns across populations to the intimate detail of individual lives. These new information territories are private and privileged, known only to the machines, their priests, and the market participants who pay to play in these new spaces. Although it is obviously the case that we are excluded because the knowledge is not for us, these chapters have revealed a deeper structural basis for our exclusion. Now we know that surveillance capitalists' ability to evade our awareness is an essential condition for knowledge production. We are excluded because we are friction that impedes the elaboration of the shadow text, and with it, surveillance capitalism's knowledge dominance. As to who decides, this division of learning has been decided by the declarations and incursions of the owners of private surveillance capital, as another essential condition of accumulation, enabled by the reluctance of the state to assert democratic oversight in this secret realm. Finally, there is the question of who decides who decides. So far, it is the asymmetrical power of surveillance capital, unencumbered by law, that decides who decides. The commodification of behavior under the conditions of surveillance capitalism pivots us toward a societal future in which an exclusive division of learning is protected by secrecy, indecipherability, and expertise. Even when knowledge derived from your behavior is fed back to you in the first text as a quid pro quo for participation, the parallel secret operations of the shadow text capture surplus for crafting into prediction products destined for other marketplaces that are about you rather than for you. These markets do not depend upon you except first as a source of raw material from which surplus is derived, and then as a target for guaranteed outcomes. We have no formal control because we are not essential to the market action. In this future, we are exiles from our own behavior, denied access to or control over knowledge derived from our experience. Knowledge, authority, and power rest with surveillance capital, for which we are merely human natural resources. Chapter 11. The Right to the Future Tense. But he had planned such future for this youth. Surely his duty now was to compel, to count on time to bring true love of truth, and with it gratitude. His eagle fell. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 9. 1. I will to will. I wake early. The day begins before I open my eyes. My mind is in motion. Words and sentences have streamed through my dreams, solving problems on yesterday's pages. The first work of the day is to retrieve those words that lay open a puzzle. Only then am I ready to awaken my senses. I try to discern each bird call in the symphony outside our windows. The phoebe, redwing, blue jay, mockingbird, woodpecker, finch, starling, and chickadee. Soaring above all their songs are the cries of geese over the lake. I splash warm water on my face, drink cool water to coax my body into alertness, and commune with our dog in the still silent house. I make coffee and bring it to my study, where I settle into my desk chair, call up my screen, and begin. I think. I write these words, and I imagine you reading or listening to them. I do this every day of every week, as I have for several years, and it is likely that I will continue to do so for one or two years to come. I watch the seasons from the windows above my desk, first green, then red and gold, then white, and then back to green again. When friends come to visit, they peek into my study. There are books and papers stacked on every surface and most of the floor. I know they feel overwhelmed at this sight, and sometimes I sense that they silently pity me for my obligation to this work and how it circumscribes my days. I do not think that they realize how free I am. In fact, I have never felt more free. How is this possible? I made a promise to complete this work. This promise is my flag planted in the future tense. It represents my commitment to construct a future that cannot come into being should I abandon my promise. This future will not exist without my capacity first to imagine its facts, and then to will them into being. I am an inchworm moving with determination and purpose across the distance between now and later. Each tiny increment of territory that I traverse is annexed to the known world, as my effort transforms uncertainty into fact. Should I renege on my promise, the world would not collapse. My publisher would survive the abrogation of our contract. You would find many other books to read or listen to. I would move on to other projects. My promise, though, is an anchor that girds me against the vagaries of my moods and temptations. It is the product of my will to will, and a compass that steers my course toward a desired future that is not yet real. Events may originate in energy sources outside my will and abruptly alter my course in ways that I can neither predict nor control. Indeed, they have already done so. Despite this certain knowledge of uncertainty, I have no doubt that I am free. I can promise to create a future, and I can keep my promise. If the book that I have imagined is to exist in the future, it must be because I will to will it so. I live in an expansive landscape that already includes a future that only I can imagine and intend. In my world, this book I write already exists. In fulfilling my promise, I make it manifest. This act of will is my claim to the future tense. To make a promise is to predict the future. To fulfill a promise through the exercise of will turns that prediction into fact. Our hearts pump our blood, our kidneys filter that blood, and our wills create the future in the patient discovery of each new sentence or step. This is how we claim our right to speak in the first person as the author of our futures. The philosopher Hannah Arendt devoted an entire volume to an examination of will as the organ for the future, in the same way that memory is our mental organ for the past. The power of wills lies in its unique ability to deal with things, visibles and invisibles, that have never existed at all. Just as the past always presents itself to the mind in the guise of certainty, the future's main characteristic is its basic uncertainty, no matter how high a degree of probability prediction may attain. When we refer to the past, we see only objects, but the view to the future brings projects, things that are yet to be. With freedom of will, we undertake action that is entirely contingent on our determination to see our project through. These are acts that we could have left undone but for our commitment. A will that is not free, Arendt concludes, is a contradiction in terms. Will is the organ with which we summon our futures into existence. Arendt's metaphor of will as the mental organ of our future suggests that it is something built into us, organic, intrinsic, inalienable. More philosophers have called this free will because it is the human counterpoint to the fear of uncertainty that suffocates original action. Arendt describes promises as islands of predictability and guideposts of reliability in an ocean of uncertainty. They are, she argues, the only alternative to a different kind of mastery that relies on domination of one's self and rule over others. Centuries of debate have been levied on the notion of free will, but too often their effect has been to silence our own declarations of will, as if we are embarrassed to assert this most fundamental human fact. I recognize my direct experience of freedom as an inviolate truth that cannot be reduced to the behaviorists' formulations of life as necessarily accidental and random, shaped by external stimuli beyond my knowledge or influence, and haunted by irrational and untrustworthy mental processes that I can neither discern nor avoid. The American philosopher John Searle, whose work on the Declaration we discussed in Chapter 6, comes to a similar conclusion in his examination of free will. He points to the causal gap between the reasons for our actions and their enactment. We may have good reasons to do something, he observes, but that does not necessarily mean it will be done. The traditional name of this gap in philosophy is the freedom of the will. In response to the sordid history of this concept, he reasons, even if the gap is an illusion, it is one we cannot shake off. The notion of making and keeping promises presupposes the gap. It requires consciousness and a sense of freedom on the part of the promise-making and promise-keeping agent. The freedom of will is the existential bone structure that carries the moral flesh of every promise, and my insistence on its integrity is not an indulgence in nostalgia or a random privileging of the pre-digital human story as somehow more truly human. This is the only kind of freedom that we can guarantee ourselves, no matter the weight of entropy or inertia, and irrespective of the forces and fears that attempt to collapse time into an eternity of shadowboxing, now and now and now. These bones are the necessary condition for the possibility of civilization as a moral milieu that favors the dignity of the individual and respects the distinctly human capacities for dialogue and problem-solving. Any person, idea, or practice that breaks these bones and tears this flesh robs us of a self-authored and we-authored future. These principles are not quaint accessories, as Hal Varian and others suggest. Rather, they are hard-won achievements that have crystallized over millennia of human contest and sacrifice. Our freedom flourishes only as we steadily will ourselves to close the gap between making promises and keeping them. Implicit in this action is an assertion that through my will I can influence the future. It does not imply total authority over the future, of course, only over my piece of it. In this way, the assertion of freedom of will also asserts the right to the future tense as a condition of a fully human life. Why should an experience as elemental as this claim on the future tense be cast as a human right? The short answer is that it is only necessary now because it is imperiled. Searle argues that such elemental features of human life rights are crystallized as formal human rights only at that moment in history when they come under systematic threat. So, for example, the ability to speak is elemental. The concept of freedom of speech as a formal right emerged only when society evolved to a degree of political complexity that the freedom to speak came under threat. The philosopher observes that speech is not more elemental to human life than breathing or being able to move one's body. No one has declared a right to breathe or a right to bodily movement because these elemental rights have not come under attack and therefore do not require formal protection. What counts as a basic right, Searle argues, is both historically contingent and pragmatic. I suggest that we now face the moment in history when the elemental right to the future tense is endangered by a pervasive digital architecture of behavior modification, owned and operated by surveillance capital, necessitated by its economic imperatives, and driven by its laws of motion, all for the sake of its guaranteed outcomes. 2. We will to will. Most simply put, there is no freedom without uncertainty. It is the medium in which human will is expressed in promises. Of course, we do not only make promises to ourselves, we also make promises to one another. When we join our wills and our promises, we create the possibility of collective action toward a shared future, linked in determination to make our vision real in the world. This is the origin of the institution we call contract, beginning with the ancient Romans. Contracts originated as shared islands of predictability intended to mitigate uncertainty for the human community, and they still retain this meaning. The simplest way to state the point of contract law is that it supports and shapes the social practice of making and keeping promises and agreements, concludes one eminent scholar. Contract law focuses on problems of cooperation, summarizes another. Contract law reflects a moral ideal of equal respect for persons. This fact explains why contract law can produce genuine legal obligations and is not just a system of coercion, observes a third. It is in this context that the destructiveness of the uncontract is most clearly revealed. Recall Varian's assertion that if someone stops making monthly car payments, nowadays it's a lot easier just to instruct the vehicle monitoring system not to allow the car to be started and to signal the location where it can be picked up. Varian calls this new capability a new contract form, when in reality the uncontract abandons the human world of legally binding promises and substitutes instead the positivist calculations of automated machine processes. Without so much as a tip of the cap and a fare thee well, Varian's uncontract disposes of several millennia of societal evolution during which Western civilization institutionalized the contract as a grand achievement of shared will. It is no secret that the institution of the contract has been twisted and abused in every age, from the requerimiento to the slave contract, as incumbent power imposes painful inequalities that drain the meaning, and indeed the very possibility of mutual promising. For example, Max Weber warned that the great achievements of contractual freedom create opportunities to exploit property ownership as a means to the achievement of power over others. However, today's UNCONTRACTS are unprecedented in their ability to impose unilateral power. They leverage the apparatus to combine pervasive monitoring and remote actuation for an internet-enabled new economics that bypasses human promises and social engagement. The UNCONTRACT aims instead for a condition that the economist Oliver Williamson describes as contract utopia, a state of perfect information known to perfectly rational people who always perform exactly as promised. The problem is, as Williamson writes, all complex contracts are unavoidably incomplete. Parties will be confronted with the need to adapt to unanticipated disturbances that arise by reason of gaps, errors, and omissions in the original contract. If you have ever seen a house built according to architectural plans, then you have a good idea of what Williamson means. There is no blueprint that sufficiently details everything needed to convert drawings and specifications into an actual house. No plan anticipates every problem that might arise, and most do not come close. The builder's skills are a function of how they collaborate to invent the actions that fulfill the intention of the drawings as they solve the unexpected but inevitable complications that arise along the way. They work together to construct a reality from the uncertainty of the plan. Like builders, people in contractual agreements undertake this kind of collaboration. It's not simply finding the way through a maze to an already agreed-upon endpoint, but rather the continuous refinement and clarification of ends and means in the face of unanticipated obstacles. This sociality of contract may entail conflict, frustration, oppression, or anger, but it can also produce trust, cooperation, cohesion, and adaptation as the means through which human beings confront an unknowable future. Were contract utopia to exist, Williamson says, it would best be described as a plan that, like other utopian modes, requires deep commitment to collective purposes and personal subordination. Subordination to what? To the plan. Contract in this context of perfect rationality is what Williamson describes as a world of planning. Such planning was the basic institution of socialist economics, where the new man was idealized as possessing a high level of cognitive competence, and therefore, it was espoused, could design highly effective plans. Varian deftly swaps out socialism's new man and installs instead a market defined by surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives, expressed through a ubiquitous computational architecture, the machine intelligence capabilities to which data are continuously supplied, the analytics that discern patterns, and the algorithms that convert them into rules. This is the essence of the UNCONTRACT, which transforms the human, legal, and economic risks of contracts into plans constructed, monitored, and maintained by private firms for the sake of guaranteed outcomes. Less contract utopia than UNCONTRACT dystopia. In November 2016, the experience of three people in the small Illinois town of Belleville was testimony to what we lose when we subordinate ourselves to the dystopian rule of the UNCONTRACT. Pat and Stanford Kipping owed their credit union $350 on their 1998 Buick. Once again, they could not make their monthly $95 payment. The Kippings credit union enlisted a local repo man, Jim Ford, to take away their car. When Ford visited the Kippings' Belleville home, he was disturbed to find an elderly couple who were forced to choose between buying medicine and making their car payments. Ford's initial response was to waive his repossession fees. The Kippings generously thanked him, invited him in for tea, and shared their story. That's when Ford decided to bridge the gap between uncertain reality and the stipulations of their contract. He did the human thing, calling the credit union and offering to pay the couple's debt. The credit union manager insisted that Ford had to follow the process. Ford continued to invoke the ancient social principles of the contract, seeking a way through the maze to something that felt like justice. Ultimately, the manager agreed to work with the couple to see what could be done. It didn't end there. Within 24 hours, an online fundraising appeal produced enough to pay off the Kipling's car, detail it, purchase a Thanksgiving turkey, and give the couple an additional gift of $1,000. Most interesting is that when a local paper picked up the story, it quickly went viral across the web and traditional media. Millions of people read and responded to this drama, presumably because it stirred memories of something precious and necessary, but now threatened with extinction. Jim Ford reminded us of the most cherished requirements of a civilized life, our shared assertion of rights to the future tense and its expression in the joining of wills in mutual commitment to dialogue, problem-solving, and empathy. He was eloquent on this point. Just be nice to people. It's not that hard. The fact that this has gone so crazy is kind of sad. This should be a daily thing, a normal thing. In the dystopia of the uncontract, this daily human thing is not normal. What if the Kipling's credit union employed Sperian's telematics and merely had to instruct the vehicular monitoring system to disable the car? There would be no loan manager engaging in a give and take with customers. The algorithm tasked to eliminate the messy, unpredictable, untrustworthy eruptions of human will would have seized the old Buick. There would have been no shared tea time with the Kippings and no one to listen to their story. There would have been no opportunity to find an alternate route through the maze, no opportunity to build trust, no occasion for collective action, no heartwarming holiday story of kindness, no glimmer of hope for a human future in which the best of our institutions is preserved and fortified, no shared challenge of uncertainty, and no shared freedom. In the dystopia of the uncontract, surveillance capitalism's drive toward certainty fills the space once occupied by all the human work of building and replenishing social trust, which is now reinterpreted as unnecessary friction in the march toward guaranteed outcomes. The deletion of uncertainty is celebrated as a victory over human nature, our cunning and our opportunism. All that's left to matter are the rules that translate reasons into action, the objective measures of behavior, and the degree of conformance between the two. Social trust eventually withers, a kind of vestigial oddity like a third nipple or wisdom teeth, traces of an evolutionary past that no longer appear in operational form because their context and therefore their purpose have vanished. The uncontract and the for-profit circuits of behavior modification in which it executes its objectives construe society as an acrid wasteland in which mistrust is taken for granted. By positing our lives together as already failed, it justifies coercive intervention for the sake of certainty. Against this background of the gradual normalization of the automated plan and its planners, the human response of one repo man bears simple witness to precisely what surveillance capitalism must extinguish. Human replenishment from the failures and triumphs of choosing the future in the face of uncertainty gives way to the blankness of perpetual compliance. The word trust lingers, but its referent in human experience dissolves into reminiscence, an archaic footnote to a barely remembered dream of a dream that has long since faded for the sake of a new dictatorship of market reasons. As the dream dies, so too does our sense of astonishment and protest. We grow numb, and our numbness paves the way for more compliance. A pathological division of learning forged by unprecedented asymmetries of knowledge and power fixes us in a new inequality marked by the tuners and the tuned, the herders and herded, the raw material and its miners, the experimenters and their unwitting subjects, those who will the future, and those who are shunted toward others' guaranteed outcomes. So let us establish our bearings. Uncertainty is not chaos, but rather the necessary habitat of the present tense. We choose the fallibility of shared promises and problem-solving over the certain tyranny imposed by a dominant power or plan, because this is the price we pay for the freedom to will, which founds our right to the future tense. In the absence of this freedom, the future collapses into an infinite present of mere behavior, in which there can be no subjects and no projects, only objects. In the future that the surveillance capitalism prepares for us, my will and yours threaten the flow of surveillance revenues. Its aim is not to destroy us, but simply to author us and to profit from that authorship. Such means have been imagined in the past, but only now are they feasible. Such means have been rejected in the past, but only now have they been allowed to root. We are ensnared without our awareness, shorn of meaningful alternatives for withdrawal, resistance, or protection. The promise of the promise and the will to will run deeper than these deformities. They remind us of that place again where we humans heal the breach between the known and the unknowable, navigating the seas of uncertainty in our vessels of shared promises. In the real world of human endeavor, there is no perfect information and no perfect rationality. Life inclines us to take action and to make commitments even when the future is unknown. Anyone who has brought a child into the world or has otherwise given his or her heart in love knows this to be true. God knows the future, but we move forward, take risks, and bind ourselves to others despite the fact that we can't know everything about the present, let alone the future. This is the essence of our freedom, expressed as the elemental right to the future tense. With the construction and ownership of the new means of behavioral modification, the fate of this right conforms to a pattern that we already have identified. It is not extinguished, but rather it is usurped, commandeered and accumulated by surveillance capital's exclusive claims on our futures. 3. How did they get away with it? In the course of the last 10 chapters, I have argued that surveillance capitalism represents an unprecedented logic of accumulation defined by new economic imperatives whose mechanisms and effects cannot be grasped with existing models and assumptions. This is not to say that the old imperatives, a compulsion toward profit maximization, along with the intensification of the means of production, growth, and competition, have vanished. However, these must now operate through the novel aims and mechanisms of surveillance capitalism. I briefly review the new imperatives here, both as a summary of the ground that we have covered and as prelude to the question, how did they get away with it? Surveillance capitalism's new story begins with behavioral surplus discovered more or less ready-made in the online environment when it was realized that the data exhaust clogging Google's servers could be combined with its powerful analytic capabilities to produce predictions of user behavior. Those prediction products became the basis for a preternaturally lucrative sales process that ignited new markets in future behavior. Google's machine intelligence improved as the volume of data increased, producing better prediction products. This dynamic established the extraction imperative, which expresses the necessity of economies of scale in surplus accumulation and depends upon automated systems that relentlessly track, hunt, and induce more behavioral surplus. Google imposed the logic of conquest, defining human experience as free for the taking, available to be rendered as data and claimed as surveillance assets. The company learned to employ a range of rhetorical, political, and technological strategies to obfuscate these processes and their implications. The need for scale drove a relentless search for new, high-volume supplies of behavioral surplus, producing competitive dynamics aimed at cornering these supplies of raw material and seeking lawless, undefended spaces in which to prosecute these unexpected and poorly understood acts of dispossession. All the while, surveillance capitalists stealthily but steadfastly habituated us to their claims. In the process, our access to necessary information and services became hostage to their operations, our means of social participation fused with their interests. Lucrative prediction products depend upon behavioral surplus, and competition drove the supply challenges to a new level, expressed in the prediction imperative. More powerful prediction products required economies of scope as well as scale, variation as well as volume. This variation occurs along two dimensions. The first is extension across a wide variety of activities. The second is the depth of predictive detail within each activity. In this new phase of competitive intensity, surveillance capitalists are forced from the virtual world into the real one. This migration necessitates new machine processes for the rendition of all aspects of human experience into behavioral data. Competition now occurs in the context of a rapidly evolving global architecture of ubiquitous computation, and therefore ubiquitous supply opportunities, as prediction products are increasingly expected to approximate certainty, and therefore to guarantee behavioral outcomes. In a third phase of competitive intensity, surveillance capitalists discovered the necessity of economies of action based on new methods that go beyond tracking, capturing, analyzing, and predicting behavior in order to intervene in the state of play and actively shape behavior at the source. The result is that the means of production are subordinated to an elaborate new means of behavioral modification, which relies upon a variety of machine processes, techniques, and tactics, tuning, herding, conditioning, to shape individual, group, and population behavior in ways that continuously improve their approximation to guaranteed outcomes. Just as industrial capitalism was driven to the continuous intensification of the means of production, so surveillance capitalists are now locked in a cycle of continuous intensification of the means of behavioral modification. Surveillance capitalists' interests have shifted from using automated machine processes to know about your behavior to using machine processes to shape your behavior according to their interests. In other words, this decade and a half trajectory has taken us from automating information flows about you to automating you. Given the conditions of increasing ubiquity, it has become difficult, if not impossible, to escape this audacious, implacable web. In order to reestablish our bearings, I have asked for a rebirth of astonishment and outrage. Most of all, I have asked that we reject the Faustian pact of participation for dispossession that requires our submission to the means of behavioral modification built on the foundation of the Google declarations. I am also mindful, though, that when we ask, how did they get away with it? There are many compelling reasons to consider, no one of which stands alone. Instead of simple cause and effect, the answers to our question constitute a broad landscape of history, contingency, quicksand, and coercion. Our question is even more vexing in light of the fact that in the great majority of surveys designed to probe public attitudes toward the loss of privacy and other elements of surveillance capitalist practices, few of us favor the status quo. In 46 of the most prominent 48 surveys administered between 2008 and 2017, substantial majorities support measures for enhanced privacy and user control over personal data. Only two early surveys were somewhat less conclusive because so many participants indicated that they did not understand how or what personal information was being gathered. Indeed, by 2008, it was well established that the more knowledge one has about internet privacy practices, the more one is likely to be very concerned about privacy. Although the surveys vary in terms of their specific focus and questions, the general consistency of responses over the decade is noteworthy. For example, an important 2009 survey found that when Americans are informed of the ways that companies gather data for targeted online ads, 73% to 86% reject such advertising. Another substantial survey in 2015 found 91% of respondents disagreeing that the collection of personal information without my knowing is a fair trade-off for a price discount. 55% disagreed that it was a fair exchange for improved services. In 2016, Pew Research reported only 9% of respondents as very confident in trusting social media sites with their data, and 14% as very confident about trusting companies with personal data. More than 60% wanted to do more to protect their privacy and believed there should be more regulations to protect privacy. Surveillance capitalist firms have tended to dismiss these survey results, pointing instead to the spectacular growth of users and revenue. This discrepancy has confounded research and public policy. With so many people rejecting the practices of surveillance capitalism, even considering how little most of us actually know about these practices, how is it that this market form has been able to succeed? The reasons are plentiful. 1. Unprecedented. Most of us did not resist the early incursions of Google, Facebook, and other surveillance capitalist operations, because it was impossible to recognize the ways in which they differed from anything that had gone before. The basic operational mechanisms and business practices were so new and strange, so utterly sui generis, that all we could see was a gaggle of innovative horseless carriages. Most significantly, anxiety and vigilance have been fixed on the known threats of surveillance and control associated with state power. Earlier incursions of behavior modification at scale were understood as an extension of the state, and we were not prepared for the onslaught from private firms. 2. Declaration as invasion. The lack of precedence left us disarmed and charmed. Meanwhile, Google learned the art of invasion by declaration, taking what it wanted and calling it theirs. The corporation asserted its rights to bypass our awareness, to take our experience and transform it into data, to claim ownership of and decisions over the uses of those data, to produce strategies and tactics that keep us ignorant of its practices, and to insist on the conditions of lawlessness required for these operations. These declarations institutionalized surveillance capitalism as a market form. 3. Historical context. Surveillance capitalism found shelter in the neoliberal zeitgeist that equated government regulation of business with tyranny. This paranoid style favored self-management regimes that imposed few limits on corporate practices. In a parallel development, the war on terror shifted the government's attention from privacy legislation to an urgent interest in the rapidly developing skills and technologies of Google and other rising surveillance capitalists. These elective affinities produced a trend toward surveillance exceptionalism, which further sheltered the new market form from scrutiny and nurtured its development. 4. Fortifications. Google aggressively protected its operations by establishing its utilities in the electoral process, strong relationships with elected and appointed officials, a revolving door of staffers between Washington and Silicon Valley, lavish lobbying expenditures, and a steady, soft power campaign of cultural influence and capture. 5. The dispossession cycle. First at Google, and later at Facebook and other firms, surveillance capitalist leaders mastered the rhythms and stages of dispossession. Audacious incursions are pursued until resistance is met, followed by a range of tactics from elaborate public relations gambits to legal combat, all designed to buy time for gradual habituation to once outrageous facts. A third stage features public demonstrations of adaptability and even retreat, while in the final stage, resources are redirected to achieve the same objectives camouflaged by new rhetoric and tactics. 6. dependency. The free services of Google, Facebook, and others appealed to the latent needs of second modernity individuals seeking resources for effective life in an increasingly hostile institutional environment. Once bitten, the apple was irresistible. As surveillance capitalism spread across the internet, the means of social participation became coextensive with the means of behavioral modification. The exploitation of second modernity needs that enabled surveillance capitalism from the start eventually imbued nearly every channel of social participation. Most people find it difficult to withdraw from these utilities, and many ponder if it is even possible. 7. Self-interest. New markets in future behavior give rise to networks of fellow travelers, partners, collaborators, and customers whose revenues depend on the prediction imperative. Institutional facts proliferate. The pizzeria owner on the Pokemon Go map, the merchant who saturates his shop with beacons, and the insurance companies vying for behavioral data unite in the race toward guaranteed outcomes and surveillance revenues. 8. Inclusion. Many people feel that if you are not on Facebook, you do not exist. People all over the world race to participate in Pokemon Go. With so much energy, success, and capital flowing into the surveillance capitalist domain, standing outside of it, let alone against it, can feel like a lonely and risky prospect. 9. Identification. Surveillance capitalists aggressively present themselves as heroic entrepreneurs. Many people identify with and admire the financial success and popularity of the surveillance capitalists and regard them as role models. 10. Authority. Many also regard these corporations and their leaders as authorities on the future, geniuses who can see farther than the rest of us. It is easy to fall prey to the naturalistic fallacy, which suggests that because the companies are successful, they must also be right. As a result, many of us are respectful of these leaders' expert status and are eager to participate in innovations that anticipate the future. 11. Social persuasion. As we have seen repeatedly, there is an endless cascade of beguiling rhetoric aimed at persuading people of the wonders associated with surveillance capitalist innovations, targeted advertising, personalization, and digital assistance. Beyond that, economies of action are intentionally designed to persuade us to follow one another along prescribed courses of action. 12. Foreclosed alternatives. The dictatorship of no alternatives is in full force here. We have seen that the behavioral value reinvestment cycle is increasingly rare. The aware home gave way to the Google home. Surveillance capitalism spread across the internet, and the drive toward economies of scope and action has forced it out into the real world. From apps to devices to the one voice, it is ever more difficult to identify avenues of escape, let alone genuine alternatives. 13. Inevitabilism. The Trojan horse of computer mediation, devices, apps, connection, enters the scene in a relentless deluge of inevitabilist rhetoric, successfully distracting us from the highly intentional and historically contingent surveillance capitalism within. New institutional facts proliferate and stabilize the new practices. We fall into resignation and a sense of helplessness. 14. The ideology of human frailty. In addition to inevitabilism, surveillance capitalism has eagerly weaponized behavioral economics' ideology of human frailty, a worldview that frames human mentation as woefully irrational and incapable of noticing the regularity of its own failures. Surveillance capitalists employ this ideology to legitimate their means of behavior modification, tuning, herding and conditioning individuals and populations in ways that are designed to elude awareness. 15. Ignorance. This remains a salient explanation. Surveillance capitalists dominate an abnormal division of learning in which they know things that we cannot know while compelled to conceal their intentions and practices in secret backstage action. It is impossible to understand something that has been crafted in secrecy and designed as fundamentally illegible. These systems are intended to ensnare us, preying on our vulnerabilities bred by an asymmetrical division of learning and amplified by our scarcity of time, resources, and support. 16. Velocity. Surveillance capitalism rose from invention to domination in record time. This reflects its ability to attract capital and its laws of motion, but it also reflects a specific strategy in which velocity is consciously deployed to paralyze awareness and freeze resistance while distracting us with immediate gratifications. Surveillance capitalism's velocities outrun democracy, even as they outrun our ability to understand what is happening and consider the consequences. This strategy is borrowed from a long legacy of political and military approaches to the production of speed as a form of violence, most recently known as shock and awe. These 16 answers suggest that in the nearly two decades since the invention of surveillance capitalism, existing laws, largely centered on privacy and antitrust, have not been sufficient to disrupt its growth. We need laws that reject the fundamental legitimacy of surveillance capitalism's declarations and interrupt its most basic operations, including the illegitimate rendition of human experience as behavioral data, the use of behavioral surplus as free raw material, extreme concentrations of the new means of production, the manufacture of prediction products, trading in behavioral futures, the use of prediction products for third-order operations of modification, influence, and control, the operations of the means of behavioral modification, the accumulation of private exclusive concentrations of knowledge, the shadow text, and the power that such concentrations confer. The rejection of these new institutions of surveillance capital and the declarations upon which they are built would signify a withdrawal of social agreement to surveillance capitalism's aims and methods, in the same way that we once withdrew agreement to the antisocial and anti-democratic practices of raw industrial capitalism, righting the balance of power between employers and workers by recognizing workers' rights to collective bargaining and outlawing child labor, hazardous working conditions, excessive work hours, and so on. The withdrawal of agreement takes two broad forms, a distinction that will be useful as we move into part three. The first is what I call the counter-declaration. These are defensive measures such as encryption and other privacy tools, or arguments for data ownership. Such measures may be effective in discrete situations, but they leave the opposing facts intact. Acknowledging their persistence, and thus paradoxically contributing to their legitimacy. For example, if I opt out of tracking, I opt out for me, but my action does not challenge or alter the offending practice. The second form of disagreement is what I call the synthetic declaration. If the declaration is check, the counter-declaration is checkmate, and the synthetic declaration changes the game. It asserts an alternative framework that transforms the opposing facts. We bide our time with counter-declarations and make life more tolerable, but only a synthetic alternative vision will transform raw surveillance capitalism in favor of a digital future that we can call home. I turn to the history of the Berlin Wall as an illustration of these two forms of disagreement. From 1961 through the early 1980s, courageous East Berliners carved 71 tunnels through the sandy soil beneath the city, affording several hundred people a means of escape to West Berlin. The tunnels are testament to the necessity of counter-declarations, but they did not bring down the wall or the power that sustained it. The synthetic declaration gathered force over decades, but its full expression would have to wait until near midnight on November 9th, 1989, when Harald Jäger, The senior officer on duty that night at the Bornholmer Street passage gave the order to open the gates, and 20,000 people surged across the wall into West Berlin. As one historian describes that event, by the night of November 9th, when the people appeared at the Berlin Wall and demanded to know of the border officials, "Will you let us pass?" those people had become so certain of themselves, and the officials so unsure of themselves, that the answer was, "We will." 4. Prophecy. Nearly 70 years ago, the economic historian Karl Polanyi reflected on the ways in which industrial capitalism's market dynamics would, if left